Hi, Susie. It's Bill.
Hi, Bill. How are you today?
I'm pretty good.
Good.
Weather's decent.
Oh, good. Yes, it is. Like we're having a gorgeous autumn here, too.
Oh, and yeah. Red.
I'm sorry. Yes, it's in Western Maryland. It is their big time of year. It's autumn glory here, so it is lovely.
Yeah. Michael, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Now, we have one other so far, Susie Cunningham's on the call.
And, good afternoon,
Susie. She's from Western Maryland. Michael's new, Susie.
That's what I was going to say. Welcome, Michael. We heard your name last year. Well, it's been a long fall. Last week, but it's good to have you join this week.
Well, I'm excited to be a part of the group.
Good. We're looking for Dan and Jennifer. And I think one of us is on vacation, not the other fellow. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
You're great. How's everything in Oregon?
Good. I'm actually in Las Vegas right now for a conference. So, I don't know if I'll be able to spend the entire hour and a half, but I'm going to stay on as long as we can, okay, before needing to go set up.
Good morning, Dan, or good afternoon, I should say.
Yes, good afternoon or good morning to you as well.
Are you at work today or are you working from home?
No. I'm going to try my best to do this from work from home the days that I do this. It keeps the distractions to really a minimum.
Oh, excellent. Okay. There are five of us on the call. We have one that's on vacation this week, so he'll be joining us next week. I'd like to introduce Michael Fitzsimmons, who's joining us for the first time. I've had a chance to talk with Michael. I'm going to ask him to kind of give you a little time on his background, and then we'll just kind of ask each of you to introduce yourselves briefly and where you're from. So, Michael, I'm going to ask you to go first, if you don't mind.
Sure. My name is Michael Fitzsimmons, and I am the Resource Development Director for the Good Samaritan Society, and I work out of Greeley, Colorado. And I've been in the position for over a year, for the last 20 years. I've been in and out of politics as well as religion. I've been a pastor, a Presbyterian pastor. Served churches in Virginia, Montana, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Iowa, and then just recently started a new church in Illinois before moving back to Colorado to be with my wife's parents, who both had open heart surgeries. So that's why I'm doing this new position. It's kind of new to me. And also I was the government relations director for the Colorado Department of Transportation for a few years and worked for a congressman for about 8 years. I've been married for 31 years. We have a daughter that's 20. And that's my background.
Excellent. Okay. Dan, do you want to just give him a brief thumbnail, if you would, of yourself?
Sure. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome, Michael. My name is Dan Shea. I'm a Senior Director of Human Resources for a firm called Skanska. Skanska is a global construction management and real estate development firm. My background really is in human resources. I've done everything from being the local HR manager, working my way up to regional roles, crossing over all business units for Skanska in the United States. And my interest in this particular program is to you know, further, you know, expand my knowledge base to use in human resources and become an internal resource for my company. I am married. I live in New York, and I have two kids, ages 6 and 12. And I'm a fairly big sports fan. So, summary about Dan Shea. Nothing too exciting.
I don't know about that. He works in the Empire State Building, by the way. So
okay,
you're just getting to...
That's right. I got free passes for the roof whenever you're in town.
Great.
Excellent. Susie, would you like to tell Mike a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Hi, Michael. I'm Susie Coddington. And, boy, listening to all the other things you've done over the years is making me sound like I haven't done a whole lot. I started my life in early childhood and child development, and I've done some actually probably different sort of things, including being a nutrition educator, sex educator. I've taught in the men's and women's prison and taught sex education and food sanitation, which was an interesting mix. And currently what I do, two-pronged, I have my own organization development consulting practice, and that's where I do my coaching from. I am also a senior practitioner faculty for Johns Hopkins and the Carey Business School. I'm married to my college sweetheart. It took me 9 years to get him, but we've been married 35 years, and we have two cats who own us. And I live full-time home is outside of Baltimore in Columbia, Maryland.
Thanks, Susie. Jennifer?
Yeah, hi, guys. This is Jennifer Powers out of Portland, Oregon, and I'm a coach, a motivational speaker, and a author of a fantastic book called O-Shift and O-Shift for Teens. Shameless plug. I'm also a mentor coach at Coach Training Alliance, which is a lot of fun. I've had my business for about 8 years. Before that, I dabbled in many different careers. But post-master's degree in sociology, I decided that it was people and groups of people that I wanted to work with and help and now train and speak to. I'm married to the man of my dreams and have two great stepboys who are 8 and 10, and a great dog named George.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you all for giving Mike a little background. Today, we're going to talk about the following. We're going to talk about, again, getting back into learning about the simple coaching model, which we'll be spending a lot of time on. And particularly, we're going to be focused a bit on the first two, really the second and third steps, if you would, to seize the coachable moment and to invite the shift. Before that, we'll kind of go back and review some other things. I'd like to start by getting back to what a coach, the two things that a coach focuses on doing at all times during a coaching session. And those two things are asking good questions and listening. So always keep in mind that if you get into a coaching situation, you keep the flow going by asking meaningful questions, and it gathers the information you need and helps develop rapport. And also, it kind of opens the client's mind. In our lesson book, page 69, it talks a little bit about well-placed questions and why those are important. Opening the client's mind and getting the client to think about possibilities rather than getting stuck on how to do something. It's really to open up options for the client and get them creative. And I think that again, we want to be sure that that when a client answers those questions, that helps the client reinforce his own, you know, processing, if you will, of information. There are some things in the material about the types of questions. If you have your information with you, I think on page 53, I think there's some information on, no, I'm sorry, not page, yeah, 60, yes, 71. All right. I don't know whether you have your books or not, but if you could get to that page, but just, there's a few things I want to just focus on for a minute.
Well, people are looking. This is Susie. I sent an email to you and Holly earlier because I noticed some discrepancy in the pagination between the electronic copy and the hard copy, but I don't think it's showing up until you get to the SD section. So I don't know if that's been problematic for anyone or not.
That's a good point. If you have a soft copy, on page 73, let's talk about the five kinds of questions for a bit. That's on the soft copy. The hard copy, it might, who has the hard copy you're looking at?
This is Michael, I do.
Okay. When you go to page 73, do you see five types of questions?
I do.
If you, oh, you do, okay. All right. Okay. So these are questions that you kind of think about. And maybe get an idea, because there's so much of what you do in asking questions that it's good to kind of understand what those are. First one they talk about is a probing type of question. Anybody got an example of what that might look like?
This is Michael again. I just had a situation yesterday. We were trying to find an individual for our advisory board. And I was probing what her passion was. Why did she want to be on our advisory board? And when I used the word passion, she never heard me, heard anybody use that. She began to open up. And I probed a little bit too deep, I think, maybe.
yeah, it's that can happen. and the big thing is to make sure that we don't again, we mentioned this in the past, Michael, but don't try to stay away from asking why questions.
Exactly. I learned my lesson.
Yeah, as you know, they can put people on defensive. You know, why do you feel that way, or why did you do that, or any of that type of thing would put them on defensive. So, what questions are always good when you're probing? What happened, how did it make, and how questions are good. So, yeah, that's an information gathering thing. They mentioned in here leading questions. To me, leading questions are dangerous because they tend to be suggesting. In other words, you're asking a question that is somewhat closed and almost makes a, it's not that you can make a recommendation within a leading question. Something like, you know, do you think you ought to do such and such? And you might give a recommendation or a suggestion at that point, and that's probably not what you're trying, not what you really need to be doing. Any thoughts on that one by anybody? Any examples they may have used? It's really not one that I'd recommend. Strategics, yeah, definitely as you look at the simple coaching model and you look toward the end in terms of framing the masterpiece, strategic questions obviously come into play about when you're trying to determine an action and also from an accountability standpoint when you're trying to ask for accountability. The challenging question can be good, particularly if the client's starting to wander away from you mentally. because it will usually come, you know, it hopefully would hit them on a more personal basis. Any thoughts on that one? You're a little quiet today, huh? Okay.
I'll jump in. This is Susie. In the mode that we always need to keep learning to keep going and staying alive, I love challenging questions to kind of move the person, the client, to the next step when they're ready, if they're not grabbing it on their own.
Good point. I think also inquiry-type questions do the same thing in terms of getting the client to kind of refocus in the session, because these sessions sometimes, hopefully the coach's mind doesn't wander, but the clients can. Well, in fact, both parties can wander, particularly if the client is into giving a very long answer for something. You tend to lose track here, and that's kind of tough. So there's more information in the supporting documents on open-ended questions. There is one I'd like to just touch on, which is I think a supporting document number 5. It's down there a ways, but it talks a little bit about. Let me find it here. Takes a little while. Well, I'm finding that one. I'm going to ask Jennifer. Jennifer, one of the things we're going to do an actual coaching session today, and I think you were down for being an observer of that one.
I think I was the client. I think Susie wanted to be the observer.
That's right, and Dan is the coach. So
yeah.
I'm going to run that in the last half an hour, but if you're going to have to leave, I might want to change that a little bit. And do it a little earlier.
Okay, I'll stay on. I don't want to mess you up, Bill. So I'll be here. Make sure I'm here.
Right. Okay, that would be helpful. Okay, let me just get down to this comment right here. I'm on page where we are here. It's SD 35. I have it on page 229. If anybody's interested, and that's just talking about the powerful questions, and just to kind of finish off on the question activity, they mentioned the most powerful questions being open-ended. Obviously, I think all of you are well aware of the fact that if you don't ask those kind of questions, you're going to get yes and no answers. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get any information if you ask closed-ended questions typically. So direct is obviously not beating around the bush, asking, being candid, being authentic. There's a book I think I mentioned last week called Fierce Conversations by Susan Scott, it's great. It's about being direct, but it's also in a respectful way. Relevancy, certainly. And then, as you look at the internal client's role, it has to be relevant to that, and so forth. And the other two are timely, of course, and impactful. The big thing is to stay on track and to stay with questions, the who, what, where, when, where, and how type questions. Let's go back now. I think does anybody want to talk at all again or any more about questions or types of questions or asking questions? Or is that pretty clear to everybody?
I'm good.
Seems clear.
Yeah, clear, Bill.
Okay. Yeah, because I think that you all get it. The big thing is stay away from the questions that put people on a defensive and use questions to get a lot of information. I'm going to move over to the client's agenda. And I think that We talked a little bit about it last week, but I think there's a few things we want to talk about this week before we get into the coaching models itself. We mentioned that, you know, the agenda in any session is belongs to the client, and just, Michael, from a standpoint of review, since we're teaching human capital coaching and it's internal, typically within an organization, hopefully the client's agenda typically would be related to getting the work done within the organization, or it may be the agenda might be something more personal, which then comes up with blockages that is impacting their ability to be effective in an organization. I think most of you probably read lesson 12. Somewhere around page 140, there was a couple of things I wanted to mention here. And let's talk about it. Sorry about that. Do you have different page numbers on your computer versus what's on the pages themselves?
Yeah, I think that doesn't start showing up until you get into the supporting documents, where that's the only place I've noticed where there were different page numbers within that tab section.
Oh, I get it. Okay. So we talked about the blank canvas last time, and Michael, you probably got a chance to look at that, and it's basically having an open mind and getting rid of your agenda so you can focus on the client's agenda. There's about page 140, there's an example of hijacking a client's agenda, and that is, it may be that in the example here, it talks about the client saying, I don't feel like working on my business plan today, even though I said that was my agenda on my prep form. But he, you know, he has something else. And that's very typical. I've run into many situations when I go to a session, assuming we were going to talk about a certain subject that we talked about and, you know, want to talk about more last time, and then get in there and find out that it's a completely different concern that's on the mind of the client. So in order to do that, of course, you always want to try to start out by asking, you know, what they would like to, you know, what's the most important thing we should discuss today? Any of you guys, I'm sure that Jennifer, you've had that many times where you go to coach somebody and then they come up with a completely different topic than you were anticipating.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or even if they've sent in the agenda, because they might do that a couple days ahead of time, and then when they get on the scheduled call, something has happened, and that new agenda has priority over what they had originally thought they wanted to talk about.
Yeah. And if the coach tries to take them somewhere else, it takes a lot of the energy out of the session. There was a comment, or there's an example in there of how you can hijack an agenda by the coach. The client's feeling frightened right now, and the coach is saying, you know, I think if you focused on your accountabilities, you'd have some direction. It wouldn't seem so frightening. And, you know, but the client wants to talk more about other things, and the coach says, that's great, but, you know, don't go too long without focusing on your accountability. So they keep, you know, the coach keeps trying to bring the agenda back to a different place. So careful of that one. We've talked about clarifying the agenda. I think that one thing that's tough as you start moving forward is what they call the tip of the iceberg. Anybody remember what that's all about?
Okay. The dangerous part isn't what you see, it's what's under the water surface.
Good point.
Sorry, that's not how it's referenced in the book, but that's because I just read that a little while ago, but the iceberg thing always pops up for me is that. Sorry.
No, that's okay. But that's always, that's always pops up when you do that. But when the way they refer it in the book is where it appears that the agenda that they say that they want to talk about is really not the real agenda. And so I think it mentions here sometimes the agenda presented is the only visible surface of a larger, more relevant agenda. And so you need to kind of explore that to be sure that, it's their agenda, but, they may not be clearly in their own minds able to express their real agenda. I find that to be very much relevant to the work I do with my Vistage group. Michael, I have a peer advisory group of business owners and CEOs. And so part of what we do is what we call issue processing. And so we start out with somebody has an issue, and the group can only ask clarifying questions. They cannot make suggestions in the first part of the exploration of an issue that they're trying to process. So by the time they get done asking a lot of clarifying questions, it turns out that perhaps the original issue is not the real issue, and so then there are suggestions made to whether, on how to restate the issue and see which one that the person with the issue, their resonance with them, and so then they work on a better issue or a clearer one. So it goes back to our first step in the simple coaching model, which is clarifying the agenda, and I will continue to emphasize that all the time because it sets the whole coaching session up, and if it's not done right, you can waste a lot of time.
Hey, Bill, this is Dan. I have a question for you, or maybe even Susie or Jennifer can chime in just in reference to agendas. I got to imagine when you are first getting engaged with a client, there's an overall agenda. There's a reason that the coaching sessions are requested to happen, whether that comes from the client themselves or a sponsor or company, whoever it may be. How long do you let it go when the agenda topics that the individual or the client brings to the conversation, to every session, if they're really not in line with what the initial reason was, do you somehow try to work it back to that, or do you just let the past go where it may? I'm just curious if that becomes a real problem for anybody, if I'm making myself clear.
Are you thinking about the topic that they're bringing forward or their agenda is not in line with what the original coaching purpose was?
Right. If the person every, we let them set the agenda on a session-by-session basis, if that's not staying in line with what the original purpose was, do you bring that up at the point to have a discussion about it, or do you try to get them back on the original path?
I've got thoughts, but I'll let the other two, if they'd like to chime in on that first, go ahead.
I Am I just confusing the hell out of everybody with the question?
No, I'm interpreting the fact that, and I just go back and let's set the scene again. Let's say we're inside of an organization. We have discussed with a sponsor the objectives of coaching somebody. We get with that person and we discuss the kind of things that we hope to accomplish out of the coaching relationship. And then you start to get into sessions and they start moving into topics that seem to be outside of what the general direction is. Am I getting, am I clarifying that?
Again, if you have a client who continually brings topics that are not in line with what the original idea was for coaching, and maybe this is not the time or place to talk about it.
I think it could be. I give you my feeling on it, and that is that I would let them go, you know, for a period of time. In terms of, you know, some sessions, maybe, depends on how many sessions you're allowed. But let's say you've got, you know you're going to do at least a dozen sessions or more. And if they start going down a different path than what the overall objectives are, I would explore it to see if, in fact, that there might be something there that's blocking their ability to achieve, what the overall objectives of the coaching relationship are. If they continue to do it too long, then we might have to do a course correction, I guess, because otherwise the corporation or the organization wouldn't feel that we're doing what they'd asked us to do. That's kind of my feeling on it. I'd like to get other input.
This is Michael. And I'm looking at page 144. It's in the section of the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And it's about the coach direct question is, what are you avoiding? And it helped the session cut to the chase. Is that something that could be used in that situation?
I think it could be definitely. Another question I've used periodically is, what are you not telling me? That might be a little, that can be kind of direct. You have to be kind of careful. But on the other hand, there needs to be an honest, open, co-creative relationship between the coach and the client. And so if the client is not stepping up, then, and you feel like they're giving you lip service, there's nothing wrong with asking more penetrating questions like, what are you avoiding? Or what are you not telling me?
And this is Susie, and I agree. I would probably not address it on the first session, but try to probe a little deeper with what's going on with this different direction. But we'll bring it back around. I'm hearing a disconnect, during the mirror thing that we initially had our agenda and our agreement to be exploring, X, Y, and Z, and I'm hearing that there's more concern over here around ABC. Can we talk for a minute about what our agenda is? And excuse me, and go back to revisit that agenda and what do you really want to get out of this?
Yeah, and I think that, again, I might let it go for a couple of sessions, because I don't want to hijack them when they're really feeling badly or strong or concerned about something, because they need to probably process with you so they can then go get back onto, what might be considered more relevant. So that's called part of the art of coaching. I know what they say about hijacking the agenda, but I think you have to make sense here that you're not hijacking something. You're letting them go down some paths, but if it goes too far or too long or too many sessions, then you're going to both find that you're not accomplishing what, particularly within a human capital coaching relationship inside of an organization. There are sponsors that are looking for certain outcomes, which were kind of agreed to, and also those rules or those outcomes and objectives were pretty much agreed to by the client, you know, when you set the stage in the very first session. So, okay. Moving on, talk about seizing the coachable moment. This is probably one of the most subtle things, but and one that gets, it's not easy to do. In chapter 13, they define coachable moments as potential roads to travel with a client toward their destination, or another way to put it is to help the client shift their perspective. The coachable moments really, the coach is where the coach picks up in a sense, some way to find out, you know, where the client wants to go and what might be a good road to go down. And we're going to see that when we do a coaching session here. On page 147, they talk about some clues that the client can provide you, which will help you to figure out that coachable moment. But they keep repeating certain words and phrases. The energy going back and forth, they seem, you know, a little bit emotional, or they make strange comments, like they don't care, that they say I don't care, you know, 10 times, and then you know that they really do care, things of that nature. And just clues to know that there's something that's bothering them that you need to kind of go after that. And I think that there's some good examples in this chapter 13 for that. You know, there was an example where the coach asked somebody how they are, and he says, I'm fine, but maybe a bit stuck. And he keeps mentioning something about he's stuck, or keep saying he's fine when he's obviously not fine. Or if they're not willing to face a certain critical piece of information in something that you're trying to ask about, you want to kind of explore that a little bit. So finding this coachable moment and which paths to go down is an interesting thing. Anybody, this is probably, to me, it's very subtle. Does anybody want to talk about whether they understand or don't understand what seizing the coachable moment's about? Okay. Because you'll find when we start, we're going to listen for that when we listen to this coaching session, so that we can try to identify when that occurred, or what was said that made that occur. Okay.
Bill, this is Susie. I think one of the things that I'm thinking of, one of my clients in particular, I notice when she gets extremely sarcastic, I mean, and almost at times nasty humor, and that's when there's a coachable moment that what's going on that's putting you into this mode. And I mean, that's kind of, just with that one client, that's something that I'm always aware of. That there's, again, there's something going on that, like, can we explore that other issue? Because, again, the sarcasm seems to be coming sort of out of the blue and not relating to what the conversation had been, the flow it had been going in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you just want to keep, yeah, and you find that, and you can, usually there's something underneath that sarcasm that basically is something you can explore, which might decide which direction to take this thing. Again, you want to take your time exploring what they might be, because you might find more than one coachable moment. It's not very black and white.
Yeah. And I have, Susie, I have a question here. If this was group coaching, because I'm thinking in more in terms of work that I do with groups that don't never really framed it as group coaching, but when I find the inappropriate use of humor, period, whether it's taking things too lightly or the sarcasm, but again, it's humor is often, the misuse of humor is often an aha for me, as much as groups that have no sense of humor is very scary for me. But are these, with these same nine types of subtle clues, could you apply those to a group that you were coaching as well as an individual?
Yeah,
and I'm sorry. I like getting off subject here. I'm sorry.
No. I think it's a good one. I think you can. I think that because they're nine individuals, and you'll listen to group dynamics. Will certain people or become leaders, or you're reading something there that. I would say that all those subtle clues can be group driven. Certainly, inappropriate humor, sarcasm, other things. But again, just listen deeply and be intuitive, and kind of let the client, just kind of listen to the client and let them let their wisdom unfold, if you will. So once you get done, and we'll talk a little bit about the next thing today, too, because we're going to listen to that. And I'm going to actually have us review a trend that transcript together before we actually get into a session and identify these things. So inviting the shift is the next thing. And I guess my first question is, who experiences the shift, the coach or the client?
Got to be the client.
And why do you say that?
I mean, I think it's, I would imagine it's not a, it's one thing if the coach can see the shift, but is it a real shift if the client doesn't feel it and be able to, kind of take off from there to something different?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it can be both. Because it is the coach, when you're doing the mirror role, if the client is so caught up in what they're saying and what they're thinking, they may not pick up on the shift in their own thinking pattern. And as a coach, if I can be that mirror or reflect and listen to, like, even if it's the, wow, I think I just heard a different direction. So I think it can be either or.
Yeah, in a sense, your job is to invite the shift. Theirs is to kind of experience it. In other words, if they seem to all of a sudden have a new understanding, or they seem to say aha, or they're inspired, or they're motivated, or they start looking at certain directions, then they're starting to see some options. So you kind of invite them to acknowledge that and encourage them to if you will, to think about some new possibilities. And that, again, you'll see how that works, I think, when we go through the models and do it. Let's go through a transcript together of an actual session, and then we'll do a session. How's that sound? If you get up
good.
To number 49 here, which is a long way down. Yeah, here it is. In fact, it actually breaks this down, because I like the way it breaks it down. So if you get to supporting document number 49, it's going to break down the four steps. So the first one, obviously, is clarifying the agenda. I'm not going to read it all, but if you're with me, the coach asks, welcome to the session, how are you? Coach, client's feeling anxious, talk to him. coach says, okay, what are we talking about today? So then the client explains, in this case, a dilemma that he has about looking for a new job in an organization that he's but he doesn't feel like he's ready yet, but he doesn't really like the job he's got and so forth. And so he's wondering if he should stay in this job if he doesn't like or go for the new job now. And so the coach reinforces that and then starts asking some other clarifying questions to kind of unpack this agenda. Which you can kind of roll through, and you know, about coach asks questions about how many years have you worked in this thing so far, and da 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 da, and then it goes on to kind of talk about you know, where you start to go to the next step, which was clarifying the if I can get to it about you know. Seizing the approachable moment. So, do you all have that in front of you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So
hard copy. It's standard your supporting document 51 in the hard copy.
Okay. So, I can get it here at some point. He spent quite a bit of time going through the first part of it. So where do you see that in this thing where the coach is now finding the coachable moment? Anybody want to take a guess there? Take a look.
Wasn't the coachable moment around the shift from 10 years to 8 years?
Okay. Anybody else have a thought on that one? I believe you're right. I think that what's happened there is that the client had this 10 years in mind, but in reality, it was just a magic number, right? So the coach basically thinks that, you know, the client admits that the 10 years is just a bias, and so the coach suggests that what would it be like to dump that bias and make your move to a higher level role now? So all of a sudden, they've got a new direction. And now he's thinking about, well, yeah, maybe I could, and I'd have to get my act together, but I could do it. So, you know, to me, that's not only finding that, but it's also actually inviting the shift. It's almost like in this particular transcript, they're very much together. Have you noticed that? Because once he decided, once they talked through the idea of getting away from that artificial time frame, then the client was ready to kind of move into preparing to do something right away. And so that, to me, not only moved into the but also move them right toward framing the masterpiece. So it's a rather short transcript, if you will, but it was just the example of which I really wanted to get out of is where the coachable moment occurred. So I think you're right. Anybody else agree with it?
This is Michael. Yeah, I would agree that the coachable moment would be the shift when the coach begins to look more in depth about the bias issues.
Okay, well let's move on and have some fun now, which is basically actually a real coaching session. So Dan has agreed to be the coach. And here's the client. And Susie, if you would be the observer, on this one. We'll go ahead and get started. So I'm going to ask Dan to take the role, and we'll all sit back and listen, and then at the end we'll comment on it. If you want to mute, only the two should be talking during this session. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay.
Sorry, Jennifer, you... Bill?
Yes?
How long are we coaching for?
Well, I'd say 20 minutes or so.
So a 20-minute session?
Yeah.
Okay.
Since this is all relatively new to me, I'll do my best to fulfill that time slot, but I'll apologize to you now, Jennifer, for what I do to you.
I'm ready.
So I guess welcome, Jennifer. So how you doing? We have a session today. What are we talking about?
Yeah, doing great. Thank you, Dan. That's something that's come up on my trip out of town, which I'm in now, and part of the trip was pleasure and part is business. The early part was pleasure, where we met with my husband's family and my brothers and sisters, yada yada, and it was lovely, but something occurred to me that I'd like to really examine further with you, and that is the dynamic of group, like the group dynamic that I find myself very uncomfortable in, which is a big surprise to me, but one that I want to examine more because it's confusing. Like it was a real eye-opener. So I want to look at my discomfort around small, intimate, familiar groups.
Okay. So why don't you start by filling me in on the group that you have been spending some time with. Size, people.
Right. So I've noticed that it's the size matters, as we all know. Let's be clear, Dan.
Jennifer, I'm new at this. You can't throw curveballs at me like that.
I know you can handle it, Dan. So size matters in the group because I'm a speaker, and I'm a coach, and I speak in front of hundreds all the time, and so it's not like size that matters. I think it's the it's size in terms of more than me and three other people. So like I noticed it was six of us, and we were doing all things together and eating together and making decisions together, and I was like, oh my God, I wanted to poke needles in my eye because I couldn't go with the flow of these six people, and I noticed I wasn't in charge of this, of anything. I was just a guest, really. So, that might be something. And, so about six or eight, I started to get really flustered, uncomfortable, and just anxious. I just want to run in the other direction. You know what I mean?
Were
and Dan, this has happened not only with my family, so it's not just a family thing. I've been on other excursions with, both traveling or business where I was with 8 or 10 people, and I literally had to, remove myself from it. I remember we're at a bar, and I was like, oh, my God, I literally had to leave. I left because I was so crazed by this herd of people that I was with. And they weren't even doing anything wrong. That's the thing. I was just wigging. It was weird.
So to clarify, to make sure I'm on the same page with you, the size of the group that has these effects on you is the larger the size of the group, the more distressed you are by it. You're more comfortable with the smaller group. Or have I got that right? Or it sounds I wrote down early on. Took a note that you had discomfort around smaller groups.
Yeah.
From understanding you, it's the larger groups that maybe sound like there's some complications for you.
Well, depending on what large is, because I realized when one of the couples left and we were just four of us, like us and another couple, I was fine. But it was that, like, over four people, you know, that it was just too much. So, like, eight and ten is just, that doesn't feel good. In an intimate group, it's more like if it's an intimate group. Like, if it's, like, I'm speaking to 8 or 10 people, it's rocking. It's not a problem. But it's when I have to, like, compromise and, like, go along with, I feel like, you know, like, I feel like I'm, like, a piece of cattle.
Okay.
I hate it.
Do you?
I fucking hate it.
Do you find that there's any type of particular person that is most impactful for you when you're in these smaller settings? Or is it just generally... People, anybody.
Yeah, that's a good question. God, the family, the people are so loving and so lovely. They're just really lovely people. But no, you know, I don't think it's the people. I don't. I mean, of course, if they were obnoxious and rude, I wouldn't naturally want to be around them. But I would find that more humorous. You know what I mean? I would probably have fun, like, in my mind with that kind of person. But when they're so sweet, like, I don't have anything, really nothing to complain about. It's more like a dynamic, just generally speaking, with that size. Yeah.
Okay. And this is not just related to family, you said. This is for any size group of people, whether it's family, friends, professional.
Business associates. Yeah.
Right.
Traveling buddies. Mm-hmm. All kinds.
Okay. I have to admit, just in general to the group, I'm a little lost on where to go with the next question for this.
Okay. Did you hear me say anything that was sort of like that could be that, you know, or like a little rabbit hole you might want to explore that sort of at a deeper level?
Mm-hmm. No, perhaps I just didn't. Maybe I just totally missed it.
Okay, so I'll repeat it. So it could have something to do with like when I'm not in control. You know, when I'm being herded around and I just feel like a piece of cattle. You know what I mean? I just feel like a member of a herd, and that could be an issue.
Tell me more about when you're not the one to provide the ideas or to make the recommendations on what should be done, and it's being done for you. How does that generally make you feel?
Yeah, good. It makes me feel like kind of like I'm being sold on something that is someone else's idea, and their idea might not be as good as mine. Clearly, I have really good ideas, right? So, if someone else thinks that we should go here to eat, it's like it might be like a great place to eat, but I'm like, no, I don't know. I just because you say it's a good place to eat, does that mean we all have to go eat there? Just because you're jonesing or craving, you know, that restaurant, does that mean we all are? Like, I feel a bit. It feels a bit unfair, like imbalanced. Yeah, that's what it feels.
Okay. Should your suggestions and your ideas be the ones that are, for the most part, used by the groups that you're with?
You broke up a little bit there. Should my ideas be what?
Should your suggestions always be heard and always be the suggestions that the group will use?
I think, yeah,
I think they should be. I do. At the moment, I'm like pretty hell-bent on my idea being a really good one. That's kind of the crux of it, you know? And I'm like, well, if anyone asked me, I would, you know, I would tell them. Or why? Like, I heard myself going, well, why isn't anyone asking me, you know? And it was cracking me up because I'm, like, having this internal dialogue with myself. And I know how hideous it is, but I couldn't stop it, you know? I just couldn't stop.
Okay. Have you thought about, so it sounds to me as if you politely sat back and went along with the activities or the recommendations of the group. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did you try to speak up to make a recommendation or a suggestion?
Yeah, totally. But the way I do it is not really the best approach. I do it like with a little bit of resentment, you know? Like a little bit of sarcasm or maybe a little rawr. And nobody loves that, you know? Feels good to me, but in the end, I wish that I had, I don't know, just sat on it, you know? Just been like, whatever, go with the flow. It's like I don't want to go with their flow, Joe. I want to.
Have you thought about other ways to suggest to do something different or to get your recommendations out there for discussion?
No, I haven't.
Could there be other ways to do it that may be more effective than the way that you're currently doing it?
Maybe.
Okay. Can you come up with one other way right now that maybe would have been more impactful than the way that you customarily throw your suggestions out there with that?
Wow. Nice. Yeah, good question. Let's think. I could have, I could have possibly said, you know, what I really feel like, or what, so you have to be hypocritical too, because then I don't want to sound like a hypocrite and say like, well, your ideas are great, and now I want my idea to be heard and followed. So I have to tactfully think of a way to say, that restaurant, what I said was that restaurant was crappy or something like that. Disgusting or nasty. I called it nasty. The restaurant that my sister-in-law wanted to go to, I'm like, oh, that place is nasty. She's like, well, I wouldn't call it nasty. I'm like, well, I would. It's nasty. Shit, you know? And so I could have probably said, well, what about, would you guys be interested in going to something with a little more variety? Or, yeah, that is so not me. That's so not what I would say.
Well, it sounds like you're making, for this example, the comments coming after the restaurant or the event had happened. What about using that opportunity as a jumping off point to suggest for the next time?
Yeah.
And maybe that being a way to do it. Could that be something that would have an impact or would help to get you where you want to go?
Sure. Yeah. I think what you're saying is after that happens, just kind of go with it and sit on it. And then, like, next time be more proactive. Is that what you're suggesting?
Be more proactive. Maybe, you know, maybe making the suggestions in a way that is a recommendation for the next event, and not just a what's coming across to others sounding like a sarcasm or maybe a nastier comment.
Would that
maybe help, would that maybe help you get to the place that you need to be, which would make it a more pleasant experience for you?
It would, Dan. It definitely would. I feel like that might be a cheap Band-Aid for me to be putting on, because I think there's something deeper. Like, I think there's
something in me that I would like to address that is the source of this. Do you know what I mean? It's the root. And there's something that, I mean, sure, I could choose words and dice them and all that, but I'm wondering, like, what this is, why it is this way, you know?
Okay.
Why?
So let's maybe go deeper with it at this point then.
Okay.
You called it a cheap Band-Aid, but there is something maybe has more substance to it for you. What spurred that thought with the recommendation that we just came up with?
Right. Well, I've been thinking about it, you know, over the last day or so since it's happened, and I'm pretty self-reflective, so I'm wondering why this pattern is, because it's not my family. Like, the questions you were asking earlier, it's like, well, could it be the people? It's actually not the people. It is this pattern that I've seen, not many times, because I think I purposely don't put myself in that position, knowing that I don't like it. So I've been thinking about it and wondering, well, it must have something to do with either control or head. Oh, yeah, like, yeah. Kind of reminds, I just got an idea, like, it reminds me of why I don't work for the man, you know? It's like, I don't want to be told what to do or when to do it. Yeah, I hate that. So it's kind of like the same thing, you know, like I find myself, even for this short amount of time, being told what to do and when to do it, and that feels icky. Yeah.
So it's a control issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a control. Just control. We don't like to work for the man. And you have in your background have done that, correct?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be some sort of connection that just kind of came to me, like, oh, yeah, it's the same feeling I get when I have a job or when I'm an employee. I used to, I really, really disliked that position. So it's probably the same thing, you know, it's like the social equivalent. Yeah, it's like the social equivalent of being an employee or a team member.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not quite sure where to go, to be honest, to the rest of the group. I'm not quite sure where to go. Hey, Jennifer, you've been great.
You're doing
carrying
so well.
Yeah, you've been very good in carrying me, but I'm not quite sure where to go at this point.
Mm-hmm. No? Okay. Before we talk about that, and that's okay. I mean, this is the first the first time, and you guys will do this a lot. And so it gets better.
Yeah.
Let me ask Susie, as an observer, for some comments first. Let's get that done, and then we'll get back to the other two, and then I'll take a few myself. Susie, as an observer, what were you seeing there?
Well, the first thing I observed is I would always like to have coaches or clients like Jennifer, because the reflective part for me came out. You'd really, if this, assuming this is a real issue, it sounds like you really have given it some thought before coming into the situation. But what I observed was the situation starting with the checking in, the how are you doing, and what Dan asking about the topic, asking about some details, and then asking again for some more clarification on the details. I noticed that Jen was also, again, a supportive client with responding several times to Dan with, that's a good question. My hat's off to Dan for saying, I'm kind of lost, I need to think for a minute, because I think, you know, my value is, my bias here is you need to allow some of that silence for your client and yourself. I just also was having a hard time because I wanted to jump in and start offering my two cents. It was very hard for me to stay quiet, and I made lots of notes as a way to keep focusing on it. But I did hear progress. I think my there was an aha moment, and my note was that I would have liked to have seen Dan pick up a little bit more on the aha. So you are a control freak. Do you want to have this as our next topic, or a little bit more going in the air? But between the two, I think they really did come to an aha.
Okay.
Too much, good. Not enough?
No, I think that, one of the things that, those are all good comments. I'm going to ask, I'm going to start with, let me ask Jennifer, how did you feel during that session?
I felt good.
Okay. Can you elaborate a little bit?
I'm not quite sure what I'll say. I felt. I don't know how I felt. I felt good. I felt. Inquisitive and curious and reflective. So, do you want more? Like, what would you like more specifics around how I felt about Dan's coaching?
Constructive feedback is what it is.
Sure. Okay, yeah, I'm happy to. So I thought Dan kicked butt. Dan, that was the first time maybe you've ever done that in this model, and I thought you did really well. And I enjoyed the time we had because I'm reflective, like Susie was, you were questioning, and the space that you allowed really gave me time to sort of come to my ahas, and I did. And that was thanks to your space, thanks to your curiosity and your good listening and what I call peeling the onion, like really kind of, okay, we got that, now let's go deeper. So you were definitely going there, and even at the point where you stopped, for me it was like, oh, we can just keep going deeper, you know, like you were doing really well. So I want you to stand in the knowing that you had some really good, really, really good, good stuff going on there. And so what I think I needed more of, and I alluded to that, was that deeper inquiry. I think Susie called it below the water, right? And I like to refer to it as sort of like a duck sticking its head down and looking around and grabbing something, you know, a little morsel of food and pulling it up. And that's what you did when you said, you know, let's go deeper. You honored that, and I really appreciated it. And it could have gone even deeper. So I would just say listen more for those moments where your client's like they're rambling, and then like they might have like a change in energy, and they go, oh yeah, could be that. And then, you know, like note that and let him or her finish and then go back. So I heard you say something about control or heard, you know what I mean? And also listen to people's, like, I'm someone, and you'll meet a lot of people like this, I'm sure, that they make jokes, or like Susie was saying earlier, they get sarcastic when there's something juicy there, you know? So pick up on those moments where they're like tells for the client, you know? It's like, oh, she's making jokes, or she's cursing, or she's laughing through it, or, you know what I mean? That's very telling for a coach, and I did offer some of that, which I was listening to on my own end. But I loved it. I thought it was quite fun. And
all
I thank
right, well,
you.
Dan, how did you feel, and what are some of your thoughts?
Okay, well, first, I appreciate all those kind words, Jennifer. That was very nice of you. Personally, I would have fired me after this session.
Fired or fired? Wait, hired or fired?
Fired.
No.
No, I. You know, it's interesting. First of all, I think I'm I think I have the good fortune of having a great group to work with, and the experiences that all of you have are going to be, you know, really helpful. And, you know, it's interesting sitting here and kind of thinking about it. I can read all this stuff in the book, and believe me, I sent Bill a note yesterday and said, you know, the expectations of coaching during this little back and forth we were going to have, and I read the book today and went through all this stuff in great detail, and it's all great, it's all very systematic and laid out, but once you get into that session, it's really listening and what your gut's telling you, and it's very it's not black and white, that's for sure, and it's not an exact science, so and I guess that's going to differ from, you know, person to person that you sit down and you coach with. So, you know, I think my first mistake was being a little too focused on, all right, check off this box, you ask these questions, you make sure you're doing this, and when in fact I needed you just kind of get my head more into the conversation and the critical listening that needs to happen. And Jennifer, you were kind enough to go back and say, Dan, this is what I mentioned this. This was the point. So it was not comfortable for me, to be totally honest. It was, though, very interesting to go through, and it was a great, learning experience, and Jennifer, I just thank you for being on the other side of that conversation. It was helpful to have you there kind of helping me along. So that's my thoughts.
Michael, any thoughts on your side on all of this?
I'm glad it wasn't me.
It will be someday, my friend.
I know it will be. I thought they both did excellent. It just, I could sense Dan was feeling a little bit afraid, and Jennifer just had so much vibrant, she was just into it. And I think it caught Dan off guard maybe a little bit. It would have caught me off guard, but I started picking up on some people.
Now I know why maybe Jennifer Stanley doesn't like her around during those meals.
Yeah. I just, control, control, control is what I kept putting in my notes after I kind of just was going through and just dialoguing, and that was a big issue. But to figure out the beginning is, what was Jennifer's purpose of having a coach? And that's why I was trying to unscramble a little bit.
Good point. Okay, good stuff. First of all, Dan, hats off to you. You did a great job first time out. It's not easy, and it does get you out of your comfort zone for some period of time. I think that from one part of constructive feedback, it might be helpful, which remember we talked about what we call the bookends on sessions. In other words, to try to, I don't know that you really asked the question what exactly she'd like to take away from this session. And you might just put that in your notes, because when you're doing the clarifying the agenda, because you're getting the topic, but when you set things up by asking that question, so at the end of the session, you can kind of ask, did you get from the session what you had wanted, what we talked about to begin with in terms of your takeaway. And it just helps bookend it a little bit. So I just make that suggestion. Yeah, it became obvious very early on, of course, that she had a control problem, which was the real problem, and that she feels good about speaking to, 500 people. She feels good about a very small group of 3 or 4 people, but when she gets into 8 to 10 or whatever that number is, she's not in control, and it's hard for her to be kind of a team player or go along with suggestions that maybe she doesn't feel comfortable with. And that certainly suggests a control issue of some kind, and perhaps. how to work that through is a very difficult thing, and not something you can do easily in one session, for sure. But certainly things to make her see it and see how would you like to, what would you like to do to make yourself feel better, or, you know, other questions along that line, because you keep probing deeper and deeper to give her an aha about maybe I've got to work on that or whatever. Those are just some thoughts. But I thought it was great. And, you know, does anyone want to try to take a stab at, and maybe we'll do this more in the future, at a couple of parts and maybe getting back to, not to put you on the spot, Susie, but as an observer, did you see a couple of spots where maybe, I don't think we've got the number four necessarily in terms of framing a masterpiece or, you know, actions to go forward with, but did you see anything in terms of where he saw a coachable, where there was a coachable moment? I think she gave him kind of a clue in some respects, but did you see anything there?
I actually think there were a couple of clues, and I have to admit, this was really hard because it was really hard for me to not be vested in that conversation. I really did want to jump into it. But a thing that I think kept coming up to me was all of the cat sounds. And the, you know, I kept thinking about, could you reframe this more positive? That the cat's a beautiful animal that doesn't like to be led. So not about having it be about control, but could it have been reframed around, are you used to being the leader? And would you be more comfortable if you could lead this group versus being a follower? And that was, again, kind of, I kept coming back to that notion of herding cats. Other than, again, I the only place I really noticed was that I thought there really was the aha moment that, and as you already said, I would have liked a little bit more kind of like acknowledgement or celebration of that aha statement. And then a little bit of it, exploring what to do. And maybe it could have been, you know, can you think of other situations where not being in control is an issue and how do you handle it there? Can you help them start solving it by generalizing? And I think I'm getting into problem solving versus observing.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and by the way, I really did see it as a not a control, me personally. I mean, my head went straight into it's the difference between being a leader and a follower, and maybe because that feels nicer to me than telling somebody they have control issues.
Well, definitely. I think you're right. I think that even if you detect a control issue, the way you state it, it's safer to say something like, you know, it appears that you're more comfortable being a leader than a follower. Is that right? Or something like that, or maybe even more open and say something like, how do you feel in those two? How do you feel in those two roles? And she'd probably come back and really be comfortable at the leader role and say, I really feel bad about it. Give us your comments.
I'm sorry, and I think I hadn't even thought about that. If you could get some distinction between, you know, what's the difference between being a leader and a follower, and going back to that, well, I didn't like working for the man, well, but when you're working for yourself, you still have other demands. What's the distinction between being an, you know, this independent, self-employed person? You still have to do something to make a paycheck. You know, build on what strategies that you already have for, again, whether it's being a leader in your own life or a leader in groups, but try to build on obvious successes, because, I mean, clearly a lot of successes going there.
Brilliant, Susie. Yeah, that reframing, this is Jen, that reframing that Susie's doing there is really awesome. I feel it just in listening to her, you know. And then pulling on successes, current or past, is also a really good direction. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, well, and I was dying to ask everybody, okay, so what's their Myers-Briggs type? I hear some real NTJ behaviors coming out there. I'm sorry, that's my bias.
Some real what? Sorry, I didn't hear that part.
I said, that was my bias. I heard a lot of sort of NTJ behaviors surfacing in your conversation.
Way to identify it. Yeah. That's awesome.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just said that, celebrating, perhaps her self-awareness is very appropriate in terms of how to get to some point in that session that where you've taken away something that perhaps wasn't as clear when you first got started, so that now the self-awareness is really factually she feels much better in leadership roles and feels, obviously, she knows she has this problem, but, just the way you discuss it and let her talk about it may bring her to a conclusion that she either wants to work on something, or she may feel like she doesn't want to be in groups of 8 to 10, and tries to avoid it. I don't know. But you want to get some, I always like to go somewhere. And even if it's a minor thing, a little thing, just acknowledging some perspective in my city in that session. Agree, disagree, thoughts? You're not going to solve the problem necessarily, or is that our role?
Well, maybe not solve a problem, but bring one closer to, I think part of this, what I'm getting from the feedback, is acceptance. I love to help my clients find acceptance in being the way they are, and mm-hmm. finding the good in that. So that's not necessarily a solved problem, but it is getting the client to a place where they're energetically able to, function or be kind to themselves or be more thoughtful about solutions. So, yeah.
Good.
And this is Dan. I think, sitting back and listening to the conversation here, I do think my head was a little geared towards solving the problem as opposed to just having the information come out and let it go its natural course. In hindsight, I really think that was what was bouncing around my head, is how do I help her address a control problem and fix that, opposed to just kind of continuing to dig deeper into it for some type of realization.
Yeah.
Good point.
This is Jen. I think what Bill said was awesome in that you would know that it wasn't a solving problem session, when you asked for the takeaway. Because if you had asked for the takeaway, and I noticed that you didn't, my takeaway would have been, I just want to understand better. I want to talk about this so I can have a better understanding, which really doesn't have to do with a solution. It just has to do with building awareness. So then that would have given, that would have freed you up. You know what I mean?
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, that would have helped you a lot.
Yeah, as soon as you said the bookends, I realized I never did ask, I asked what we're going to talk about today, but I never said what are we hoping to walk away with.
Right.
Well, it kind of gets you off the hook of thinking that you have to come up with some big solution.
Right.
And I know that sometimes that I'm terribly guilty of it. I mean, men are famously accused of it, and that is when you're talking to your woman or your spouse or whatever. We like to solve problems all the time. We like to fix them. If it's broken, we fix it. And my wife has finally pounded into my head the fact that I just want you to listen to me.
Yeah.
I just want to talk.
Or at least we think we fix it.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
I don't think that's exactly a male gender issue. which any mother with a kid, and they want to solve all of those kids' problems for them. So I can't leave that as a gender-only issue.
I'm glad you didn't, but it seems to pop out that way. Maybe it's just because, you know, you get that back from the other gender more than you do from your own gender.
And it's the reverse of my household. I'm the one telling my husband, I don't want you to even comment. I just want you to listen to me. And of course, I have to talk problems out, so there's a whole lot of this. Just hear what I say. Don't try and fix it. So it's a role reversal in my household.
Well, again, I appreciate everybody's time. It's time for us to bring this to a close. And by the way, if we struggle together, that's really where the learning takes place.
Yeah.
It's great to talk about what they say in the book, but as Dan pointed out, doing it is a whole different ballgame. So, Dan, thanks. Congratulations. And next week, before we leave, I'd like to change it around. We'll let the guy on vacation off the hook once. But I'd suggest that who would like to coach next week? Susie, would you like to be the coach?
If you would like for me to coach, I would do that.
Of course I would. And then, Dan, would you like to be the client?
Sure.
Okay. And then, Jennifer, it could be the observer, and then after that, we'll get Michael in the act and others in the act. Give them a couple weeks to get used to it a little bit.
An observation?
Yeah. Please.
Bill, your energy level in your voice right now is so much higher. I was really worried about you the first part of the call. Your energy level sounded really, really down.
Okay. Well, appreciate that. That's good observation.
And I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. And anything else before we part?
No, but yay, Dan.
Yeah, way to go, Dan.
Yeah, no, thank
you. We'll see you next week.
Okay. We have a great week.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.